Welcome to Take Note. I'm Patty Satalia. This week, WPSU's Greg Peterson speaks with Republican Pennsylvania Senator Jake Corman about Governor Tom Wolf's just-released state budget. Corman represents the 34th Senatorial District, which includes all of Center, Mifflin, and Juniata counties, and part of Huntington County. He serves as the majority leader of the state Senate.
Senator Corman, thanks for joining us here on Take Note.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Governor Wolf has released his budget for the upcoming year. Are there aspects of the budget that you can embrace?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the governor, I think, has steered away from where he was 2 years ago. 2 years ago, he saw some of the problems and he proposed a large tax increase, which was not supported by the legislature or the people of Pennsylvania. And so fast forward to this year, we still have significant issues, and he's tried to put some different type of proposals forward to reform government, to consolidate government. Not necessarily supportive of all of them. I think we need to go walk through each one of them one at a time and give them, the legislature's job is oversight. So it's our job to sort of review the proposals, see what we think works, what doesn't work. But the problem with this budget proposal in totality is that the issue that's driving state government, and we've probably talked about this on a show before, is public pensions.
Right.
Between public pensions and between retirement for senior citizens in Pennsylvania, particularly dealing with Medicaid, long-term care, those issues are raising at a significant cost and far faster than what our revenues are growing. And so, therefore, we're constantly in budget pressures. And so whether it was a tax increase 2 years ago or whether it's reforming state government this year, neither one of those are attacking the problem. And the problem is public pensions and long-term care. And until we deal with those issues, we're always going to be in this budget deficit. We could take all the governor's proposals, and some of them have merit, don't get me wrong, and we'll review them, and I think we'll implement some. But we'll still be back in the same spot next year, which is a place where our revenues are growing, our expenses are growing faster than our revenues.
Let's dive in a little bit more to the pension thing. What solution do you have? You know, you proposed something last year that was a hybrid of sorts.
Well, 2 years ago, we proposed and passed Senate Bill 1, which if the governor would have signed, we'd be in a much better position than we are today. But today, we're going to be trying to pick up a bill again in March, which essentially would begin to transition us from a defined benefit to at least a combination of a defined benefit, defined contribution. The defined benefit plans are sort of a thing of the past. They were created for government. I mean, my private sectors have as well, but, sort of the trade-off for public service was you weren't going to make quite as much as you could out in the private sector, but there would be security. And that was a pretty fair trade-off. While now with, A, people living longer, which is a good thing, but B, because of collective bargaining in public sector, now the salaries aren't necessarily lower than average. A teacher's salary is probably above the medium average in a lot of communities. And so public service contracts have gotten higher. And so therefore, the benefit structure isn't quite as necessary as it was to attract people into the public sector in the past. So dealing with the demographic changes, dealing with the problems we've had in the system, it's time for us to move away from that defined benefit. Moving forward, anyone who's currently in the workforce, we wouldn't be talking about those individuals at all. We're talking about new entries into the workforce. Begin a proposal that's called a side-by-side where they would still have a small component of a defined benefit still, but half of their contribution would go towards a defined contribution. So that would remove the risk away from the taxpayers, which right now, the taxpayers hold all the risk in these plans. And this would remove the risk away from it at least by 50% and put us on a much a better trajectory for the people who are doing budgets, whether it be the school district level, the state level, or Penn State University level, a much more predictable path so that they can budget for it a lot better. Now, we're not sure what we're going to get every year, and in many cases, between that and healthcare, they're getting significant increases in their payment structure that the employers have to pay.
I understand going forward, this would be a great way to ameliorate the cost. But what about the cost that we have now that we're on the hook for, the taxpayers on the hook for a huge bunch of people who are retiring soon?
Act 120, which we passed in 2010, has us on a trajectory to pay it off. And obviously, we were growing significantly. We used to contribute probably in 2006, we were contributing around $500 to $600 million a year as the employer. That would be our share of the contribution. to the system. You have an employer contribution, which is the state or the school district. You have the employee contribution, which is predetermined. And then you have returns, investment returns. And those three things fund the system. In 2006, we were probably paying as the employer around $600 million to the two systems to fund the systems. Mm-hmm. We're now paying in excess of $3 billion. So you can see why our budgets are having problems, because we're making room for that increase. And that's going to continue to increase. Now, on the Act 120 payment, it's supposed to level off and then stay there for about 30 years. Having said that, if we're not making our investment returns, which the plan calls for, which is about 7.25%, then the taxpayers have to make that up. And that's where I said the risk is involved. If they're making more than that, then taxpayers benefit. If they're making less than that, which we have been for some time, last year we barely made a percent, which is sort of hard to calculate when the Dow's over 20,000, that we're not making our number. What's going to make our number? I don't know. So the risk is all within the taxpayer. And so the taxpayer has to make up that difference over a period of time. And so, you know, the taxpayer will still have to make contributions to pay off the old system.
And it does sometimes affect the taxpayer in the form of their property tax, because the school systems have to pass it on to the people in the school districts. And that's why school taxes are seemingly going up on a regular basis.
Absolutely. I mean, I only talked about the state problems there. We're going from $600 million to $3 billion. School districts have had to go right along. Penn State University, as a separate employer that was forced into the CERT system decades ago, has to continue to pay that as well. And so their contribution levels are going up significantly. And, you know, if you're, you know, a local school district is trying to keep increases at 2.5%, you know, as far as overall budget, somewhere around the cost of living, you're probably already ahead of that just with pensions. To give an example, you know, the governor's budget calls for $100 million in increase in basic ed subsidy for our local school districts,
mm-hmm.
$25 million more for a special ed to our local school districts around the state. So that's $125 million he's proposing to local school districts. That doesn't even cover their pension obligation increase payment. So that's not going into the classroom. That's not going into buying textbooks. That's not going into any new infrastructure improvements. That's just going to pay the increase in the pension obligation, and it doesn't even cover it all. So you can see where the school districts have the same sort of problem that the state has in trying to keep their costs down at a time when, you know, and we didn't even talk about healthcare. You know, healthcare yeah. is on top of all that. You know, right now, to be in the employment business where you have large scale employees like government, like school districts, that cost is growing at a significant rate. You know, you're seeing school districts and states don't probably have this big a deal, but you know, you're seeing in private enterprise where they're getting 30, 40, sometimes 50% increases in their health premiums.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're a large employer, you can imagine that cost.
And it should be pointed out that Penn State has for well over three decades offered employees a choice of the Sears or TIAA, TIAA Craft.
Right. And many choose it.
Right.
You know, for all the people who are sort of fearful of the defined contribution system, and that's mostly union leaders, you know, the average employer or the average employee and the student in the PSER system, which is the state education retirement system, basically our schools, the average employee only stays about 10 years, which maybe is a state of education today and how difficult it is. But actually, a defined contribution plan works better for them because it's portable. You can take it to your next wherever you're going to work after you leave that system, where defined benefit is not. So I think moving more toward defined contribution is a positive for many reasons.
Okay, go back to the budget now. What parts of the budget do you believe really just won't work from your point of view?
Well, I'm not a big fan of selling the Farm Show building. You know, the governor proposed leasing it, essentially, getting a one-time payment of a significant amount of money and then renting it back over leasing it back over years, which we'd pay a lot more over years than we would for the upfront cost. You know, you do that sort of thing if you're doing a big infrastructure improvement. You know, if you wanted to, you know, if you're building something you need upfront cash for, then you pay it off over a period of time. But you don't do that to put the money in the general fund to pay operating costs. So that I obviously have a problem with. The governor's proposed to zero out our only veterinarian school in the state, University of Pennsylvania, which has always gotten a subsidy from the state over the years, and another form of higher education that we have here. And I think that would be a mistake to zero them out. You know, so the combination of the human services basically wants to consolidate five departments. He wants to consolidate Department of Human Services, Department of Health, Department of Drug and Alcohol, and one more, it escapes me at the moment, all into one department.
Right, one health department, as it were.
Yeah, and this is where you got to listen to the governor's plan and understand it before you can render a final opinion. If he can consolidate costs, and although he said he's not laying anybody off, so I'm not sure how you save money if you're not laying people off. But if you can consolidate and save costs, that's okay, and that's positive, and we should try to do that. Having said that, it also would be one of the largest bureaucratic departments in the country, and so now you have this big monstrous department, which a appointed public official, the governor's appointee to be the secretary, has to oversee. There's sort of a saying in state government amongst the employees is, we're here forever, you're here for part time. And that's how they look at some of the secretaries. And so, Department of Human Services is a very complicated department with a lot of different directions. And you want to make sure that someone can oversee it and not have a big bureaucratic problem. So, but again, it's a aggressive, interesting proposal by the governor. We need to hear it out and to see how it would work. But that would be my sort of what jumps out at me as a concern. I like the cost savings. If we can do it, we should. But I also don't want to make this huge monstrosity of a department that no one can wield and make work the way taxpayers need it to work.
Obviously, the Department of Corrections is one of the big items in the budget, and the governor moved to close one instead of four. There's rumored four. They're going to close one SCI Pittsburgh, and that'll do some savings. But what that does is just cause more population in the other state prisons. What type of prison reform do you think we need to get a hold of that cost as well as the incarceration rate?
Sure. This gives you an example of what the cost of employing people are. Back 10 to 12 years ago, we were increasing our prison population by about 1,500 new prisoners a year, which essentially means you have to build a new prison every year, which obviously comes at a great cost. Through justice reinvestment reform that we've done over the last 6-7 years, we've been able to reduce that growth to a flat growth, where we're not growing anymore. And actually, we've had some reduction. So that's great. But even with that flat growth, the department as a whole budget grew about $150 million a year because of all the personnel that they have to have and the personnel costs. So the governor's proposing, which I'm supportive of, that we've now gotten a prison population where we can reduce the amount of infrastructure we have, a.k.a. a prison. He thought about putting two on the block. He ended up just doing one. He's going to close down a facility in Pittsburgh. Those other prisoners will be distributed throughout the state. A lot of them, I think, are going to Camp Hill, where they just opened up a new wing there. And the personnel will either be asked to move, and they can move into different facilities, or through attrition, go to retirement. And we won't have to replace them. So I think this is a place, because of the justice reinvestment we did years ago, we've been able to manage our prison population. And now we can close down our infrastructure. And anytime you have a building of that size, that's a significant amount of cost. So by just closing one facility, that's going to have some savings for us. Hopefully we will continue to be able to do this as our justice reinvestment legislation continues to take place. Our goal is obviously incarceration for a reason. It's for individuals people who commit significant crimes or serious crimes that are harmful to the communities that they live in. But there's also ways to get them through in rehabilitation so they don't come back. Right now we have a fairly large recidivism rate, about 50%, come back to prison after they're serving their term. They commit another crime. Well, I always tell people, this isn't a Holiday Inn where we get, say, come back again sometime soon. We don't want you ever to come back. And so we need to do a better job in putting some money up front, working on individuals while they're in incarceration so that they have a way to support themselves and have a livelihood once they leave our incarceration so they don't come back. So that's, a big part of what we need to accomplish as well, and we're trying to do through justice reinvestment. So, it's a variety of approach. We've reformed our probation parole. Some people were serving maximum sentence just because we couldn't get them through the parole system because of the bureaucracy that was there. So we are working through that, and we've seen success here where we can close a facility. I'd like to see us be able to close some more. Now, as someone who represents four state correctional institutions, and I understand the job market that goes with that, and that's positive for a community. Having said that, I'd like to find economic development ways other than prisons to find people employment.
In an ideal world, yeah, you want at least amount of people in prison.
Sure.
So if you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. Our guest today is Republican Senator Jay Corman, who represents the 34th Senatorial District, and Senator Corman is also the majority leader in the Senate. It seems that every Pennsylvania border state adopted a minimum wage higher than $7.25. Pennsylvania is the one spot where it's still $7.25. A lot of local businesses themselves, major retailers like Walmart, even McDonald's, they've gone past that. Is it time for the state to adopt a higher minimum wage?
It's like anything else. It's a matter of whether you can get to a number that everyone's comfortable with. You know, the governor proposed $14.
Right.
We're not going to get to $14. That would have such a shock overnight to the system that a lot of people would be unemployed soon after that because employers couldn't absorb that significant increase overnight. If we can get to a point where we can phase in some increases, I think we should. I'd like to see the federal government do it because I think we should be pretty similar to other states. The federal government hasn't moved on it, so I'm happy. And we discussed this last year about trying to move forward on that issue. Problem is the advocates were so high up and we couldn't make progress. You know, it's important to make progress. And if we'd increased it, you know, a dollar and a half last year, we'd be better than we are today. Unfortunately, you know, people sort of like to reach for the sky and they don't get what they want. They don't accept something less. So I think we can move forward on minimum wage increase, but I think we got to do it in a phased in slower fashion than what has been proposed. And we'll just keep working with the governor and those advocates to see if we can come to some sort of compromise.
Several states have established a minimum wage around $8.50 or $8.75, and then they increase it on a regular basis by the CPI.
Mm-hmm.
Like every 2 years, they look at it and say, okay, it needs to be increased this
way. I think that's more in the ballpark than what we should be looking at as opposed to what the governor's proposed. But you know, again, compromise is always the key thing here, and we just have to see where we can get to.
Okay. In the past several years, it just seems like the public perception is that the budget gets put together with a lot of stopgap funding measures, one-time funding mechanisms to get us through into the next budget. This is becoming a habit, unfortunately. Where's the solution to that not happening?
Addressing the two issues I talked about earlier. Until you address the cost drivers. Now, what is driving up your budget?
Percentage-wise, how much does the budget does legislature really control?
I mean, if you start your budget process, first thing you got to plug in automatic costs.
Right.
Right. You got to pay these no matter what. You know, Medicaid, long-term care, or federal entitlement programs. So if you qualify, you sign up, you get it. There's no discretion. You know, at the state level, we help administer it, but it's a federal entitlement. Obviously, public pensions is a contract. It's something we have to pay, as are increases in contracts at, you know, the AFSCME contract for the state employees. These are things you have to pay. Our problem is when you plug all those in, you're looking at $1 to $1.5 billion new dollars, and you haven't even started. You haven't even started putting a dollar into education. You haven't started to put a dollar in economic development. You haven't put a dollar into agriculture, whatever kind of the budget you like, environmental protection. You've already increased your budget by 4 or 5%, and you haven't even started. So therein lies the problem because the revenues aren't keeping up with that. And so if you want to make any investment, and look, I'm a big believer that the state does have a role to invest in Pennsylvania, to not only invest in its education, but to invest in its infrastructure, to invest in ways so that private enterprise can come in and be successful in Pennsylvania. That's ultimately what you're looking for, is private enterprise to employ people so that, you know, people can have family-sustaining wages, they can support their families, they can contribute to their communities. So I believe the state does have a role to play a part in that. Our ability to play a part of that is being dwindled every year because of our costs. Essentially, if you're, as a business, put in a business perspective, you know, your operating costs are at one level, which is low, and you want to be able to invest in the future. Well, our operating costs are so high, it's stunning our growth to be able to invest in the future. And if you're in private enterprise, you're going bankrupt with that scenario. And so our job, you know, as I said, you know, we have been to try to avoid tax increases on, you know, and try to avoid the burden on the people of Pennsylvania. We've been trying to sort of keep our fingers in the dike and don't let it fall behind us. And as you said, we've used one-time costs, we've used one-time expenses, and we've been able to do it. But every year we're back in the same spot. And what I've been advocating for, I did an op-ed piece on this earlier, is enough is enough. Now, these changes that I'm advocating for won't give us any savings today. That's one of the detractors would say. Well, you're not saving any money if you do the pension reform you're talking about. You're right. But you know what? 5-10 years down the road, it is going to save us money. And it's high time government starts looking, you know, stop governing by crisis and look to the future. You know, we have a tendency to look year to year, not as a private enterprise or as a family would do, and look 10, 20 years down the road. We don't do that. And so I'm dealing with legacy issues, whether it was tough on crime bills in the 90s that exploded our prison population, whether it was the pension reform plans that were passed in early 2000s, which has given me this, whether it's been we have the second most expensive Medicaid program in the country above the federal entitlement. These are all things that they've passed in the past, not worrying about what those costs would be in the future. Well, here we are in the future, and we have these costs. So we're not going to be able to dig our way out of it overnight, but we're not going to get there anywhere until we start digging, and or at least stop digging the hole and start fixing the problem. So, you know, I'm advocating to make these tough changes. We'll still have to make difficult decisions, and that may, you know, be some revenue increases. That may be some difficult cuts, whatever they may be. But I can't do that until I start solving problems. I can go to my constituents and say, look, there's some pain to swallow here. No one likes pain. No one likes taking medicine because it tastes terrible. But we know it's going to make us feel better in time, and so we take it, right?
Sure.
Same thing here. You know, you are going to have to – but you wouldn't take that medicine if it wasn't going to solve your illness, right? It tastes terrible. You're not going to take it if it's not going to solve your illness. So for me to ask my constituents to absorb some pain, whether that be go without services, whether that be to pay more in taxes or whatever that might be, I have to solve problems. And I have to tell them, okay, this is the pain we're absorbing. It's not any fun, but we've now fixed the problem and we're not going to face it again. And that's what we haven't done. And until we do that, we're going to continue to be in the same position.
And it's a matter of convincing the citizens that foregoing current gains for future benefits is something they should be wanting to do.
And I think when you talk to people, they understand it and they get it. Look, unions are the biggest opposition to this, and the public employee unions, not the private unions. And look, that's their job. Their job is to try to get the best benefit that they possibly can for their constituents, their union members. I get that. I don't have a problem with them advocating for it. I, as a legislator, had to look past that. I had to look past the special interest and look at the total interest of the Commonwealth. And to me, the overriding concern is the fiscal stability of the Commonwealth. And that's why we had to make these changes I've been suggesting moving forward. I think we still provide a very significant benefit for our employees, and it's important to be able to track good employees to our schools. It's important to be able to track good employees to state government. But I think we still have that in place that people will want to be employed there despite some of the changes I've suggested.
It seems like every conversation with any politician nowadays talks about opioids. Mm-hmm. What's your take on it? What does the state need to do? How do we get involved in trying to stop the crisis of it?
Well, it's probably the number one public health issue in Pennsylvania, if not the country.
Isn't there something in place now where a person can go into a pharmacy and get a dose of Narcanon, the anti-opioid drug, and just have it in their home?
Yeah, we just moved some legislation dealing with that sort of thing, and I believe that was one of them. We had about 6 or 7 bills run through last year. Here's the issue to me. This goes back to being a partner. There's no piece of legislation in Harrisburg that's going to solve this problem.
Right.
What we want to do is partner with our healthcare communities, our law enforcement, our educators, our community leaders to help them and to partner with them to begin to put a to put a stop to this, to at least lessen the crisis that we're in now. I think you're seeing in the beginning with the medical professionals and their different way of prescribing and dealing with, you know, pain management for people. You know, it's funny. I was my son had surgery recently, and, you know, he got some pain medicine for it. And I was constantly harping on him. Okay, we need to move away. We need to move away. And he's like, he looked at me and says, Dad, did someone in your family get addicted to this at one time? And I said, no. But I said, you know, I don't want it to happen either. And so, but me just as a consumer sees it. And so educating people to this problem is the first component, which I think you're beginning to see, that just people on their own are going to say, all right, we need to be able to figure out a way to manage this without constantly relying on opioids. So that's part of the process. So we want to be helpful in all those facets, not just law enforcement, but but in education and in public awareness and our healthcare professionals to get the word out, to provide whatever tools that they need to provide. I'm certainly not an expert on it. I'm learning as well. One of the things that I'm proud of is in our Senate caucus, Gene Yaw is the senator from Williamsport area, and he's the chairman of Rural Pennsylvania, Committee for Rural Pennsylvania. And he's been holding hearings for the last 3 years on this issue. And you would think, wow, Committee for Rural Pennsylvania, why is this a big issue? Well, it's a big rural Pennsylvania issue. It's not just based in urban Pennsylvania. And so, we've been trying to educate ourselves, trying to develop policies, trying to give law enforcement tools as well as when they come across someone who's overdosed, they now have products. I'm not sure. Naxone or something like that. I'm trying to get the right terminology that they can help. They can prevent the overdose. So it's only going to be a problem that if we all come together, can we begin to make a dent and a resolve. And I think we're in the right direction because now, the first part of it, what's the old saying, solving a problem is identifying it. And I think most people have identified it. And just, my own personal case, my son and actually myself, and I had surgery recently, okay, this is nice, but I gotta move off it quickly.
Been there too.
And that's through public awareness. And I think more of that with some other tools, hopefully we can begin to deal with it because it is, as I said, the number one public health issue in Pennsylvania.
Senator, we have about a minute left. Are there any pieces of legislation or any issues that you're particularly interested in this session?
Well, I sound like a broken record, but since I've been the leader, I see my job is to take on the big problems. We have a large caucus, and most of the people who have come to Harrisburg have come to solve big problems. And without question, the number one problem is public pensions. And look, I represent probably as many state employees and public employees as any district in the Commonwealth, outside of maybe the senator from Harrisburg. So I'm not looking to obviously politically do something that's going to hurt my constituents. Having said that, we have a problem, and we need to be able to be grown up about it and think about it and fix it and not look to whatever sort of is politically popular at the time. People looking to do politically popular things have got us in this mess, and now we got to do what's the right thing. And if it costs us our jobs, then fine. It costs us our jobs, but we're going to put some future legislator in a lot better position than what we're in today as far as the budget goes and be able to invest in the future. So that's my biggest issue that I'm going to continue to push. We passed a lot of significant legislation in the first few months, but we're going to take this up in the beginning of March and hopefully come to some sort of agreement with the House and the governor.
Senator Jay Corman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That was WPSU's Greg Peterson speaking with the Pennsylvania Senate's Majority Leader, Jake Corman. Next week, we'll get Representative Mike Hanna's perspective on the state budget and the budget process. Hanna represents the 76th Legislative District, which consists of Clinton County and parts of Center County. He's also the Democratic whip in the House. For Take Note, I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.